some would see a sizable appropriation bill, some would see as not big enough. Mr. President, I think it's just about right.
The state Senate passes the capital projects budget. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, April 11th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the struggle to sink the tsunami ghost ship.
She was a very seaworthy craft, obviously coming thousands of miles, and she didn't want to go down easy, that's for sure.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers competitive interest rates with programs tailored for first-time homebuyers and home choice seminars that cover the details of purchasing and financing a home. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
Governor Sean Parnell says he will call Alaska lawmakers into special session if the Senate passes an oil tax bill by Sunday. The session is under a statutory deadline to adjourn by that day, but with a key piece of legislation still pending in the Senate, Parnell says he wants to make sure the House has time to evaluate the version that emerges. The governor this morning met with House and Senate leadership teams to discuss the end of session items, and Senate President Gary Stevens says the tax plan that is expected to be approved by the Finance Committee today did not face the opposition that earlier versions have drawn. Parnell says he also wants action on the operating and capital budgets and an in-state gas pipeline bill, as well as full funding for his performance scholarship program. Stevens says the original goal was to have the tax bill through the Senate and to the House for consideration by the end of the day. The Senate unanimously passed a $2.6 billion capital projects budget today, a bill that Finance Co-Chair Bert Stedman says is another step toward keeping Alaska's economy strong.
Some would see a sizable appropriation bill. Some would see as not big enough. Mr. President, I think it's just about right. It's similar to where we were a year ago in overall appropriations. It's the balance, I think, that the state of Alaska as a whole can absorb very well. We could keep our road construction projects, our building projects, and our planning all kind of rolling along so we don't have dips in our economy.
Stedman says the Senate version adds $721 million to the budget the governor introduced and still leaves room for House members to add their own priorities. The Senate received and made decisions on 1,800 project requests from communities across the state, which would have represented $3.8 billion in more spending.
The concentration on the capital budget was to grow our economy and help it diversify and lower the cost of living for Alaskans. And in doing so, we concentrated on energy and other enhancements to further that endeavor and also create jobs.
The bill passed on a 20-0 vote and has already been sent to the House. Work is underway on their version of the bill. The Arctic has crossed the threshold from winter into spring. Scientists at the National Snow and Ice Data Center announced last week that Arctic sea ice reached its maximum extent on March 18th and is slowly beginning its summer retreat. But the Bering Sea has record ice extent for part of the winter, KUCB's Stephanie Joyce reports.
Despite a chilly winter in some parts of the Arctic, the overall ice cover was the ninth lowest since the satellite record began in 1979. That's still a sizable amount of ice, 5.9 million square miles, or roughly the size of the United States and Canada combined. But it's about 200,000 square miles less than the 30-year average. Most of the missing ice was in the Barents and Kara Seas above western Russia, where higher-than-average temperatures kept sea ice from forming. Meanwhile, closer to home, the Bering Sea had record ice cover in February and March, and it remains well above average even now, halfway through April. Walt Meyer is a sea ice researcher at the National Snow and Ice Data Center. He says a persistent low-pressure system south of Alaska is responsible for the Bering Sea's extreme ice.
Basically, what that did, that brought the circulation from kind of from the north or the northeast out across the Bering Sea, and that essentially, it does two things. Number one, it brings cold air down into the area, so that cold air helps ice form, but it also pushes the ice southward, and so you keep kind of pushing the ice edge southward because of the winds blowing from the north.
Air temperatures over the Bering Sea averaged 11 to 14 degrees colder than usual this winter, which pushed the ice edge as far south as the Aleutians at times. But the extent wasn't the only unusual part, according to Meyer. Heavy ice flow through the Bering Strait created a formation called an ice arch several times this winter. It's a little complicated, but basically the strait acts as a choke point for the ice when it's moving south. If there's a lot of ice trying to flow through the strait all at once, it tends to start piling up. And when enough of it accumulates, it locks together in such a way that it creates an arch and stops the southern flow. Meanwhile, the ice that's already passed through the strait continues on its southern trajectory, creating a swath of open water between the arch and the rest of the ice pack. Meyer says the formation hasn't been seen much since the 1970s.
We haven't seen it happen a lot recently, and that may be partly due to the Arctic used to be covered with older and thicker ice, so that older and thicker ice was stronger, so when it kind of get crunched together by the Bering, north of the Bering Strait, you would see these ice arches form. That thicker ice is stronger, and lately we've seen more thinner seasonal ice cover that breaks up more easily and probably flows through a little more easily.
Meyer says any thicker ice that's formed in the Bering Sea this year won't stick around for long, though. The Bering Sea's ice is seasonal and completely disappears by midsummer. Meyer says that makes the record-breaking ice extent less significant in terms of the overall Arctic.
From a climate perspective, it's not a big factor in the long-term trends, and it's not going to be a big factor in the summer extent this year.
Reporting in Unalaska, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
State Representative Sharon Cisna is running for Don Young's seat in Congress. She filed her paperwork with the Alaska Public Offices Commission this morning. Cisna is a Democrat who currently represents the University Medical District in Anchorage. She says her main issue will be reforming the Transportation Security Administration. The TSA has been a target of Cisna's since she refused an invasive pat-down at the Seattle airport last year. She ended up taking the ferry to Juneau instead. She says Congressman Young hasn't done enough to change the way TSA handles airport screenings.
He hasn't put forth the kind of oversight responsibility that Congress has to stop jobs that are being done very, very poorly, that actually are hurting Americans. And that's what's happening with TSA. And he has not gone after them, and that's his job.
Cisna was elected to the legislature 14 years ago and has been in the House minority ever since. Congressman Don Young issued an email statement today saying he welcomes Representative Cisna to the race and is looking forward to the campaign season. Anchorage resident Garen Tarr is running for Cisna's seat as a Democrat. Tarr is 36 years old and teaches biology at the University of Alaska Anchorage. She says making sure Alaska gets its fair share of oil taxes will be a focus for her, along with education.
One of the things that excites me about my district is there are gobs of children, a lot of young families, and so education is a primary concern for folks and making sure that their kids have good schools and good educational opportunities.
Cisna's current district, 22, used to be comprised mostly of the University Medical Area in Anchorage, but under the redistricting plan will include the Mountain View neighborhood. The new district is 17. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, lawmakers consider subsidizing immunizations again.
This program has held at bay a number of terrible diseases that are not just life-threatening, but they're also life-altering.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The Anchorage Assembly has voted no on appointing an independent counsel to investigate the municipal election and called a special work session to review the situation. The announcement comes a week after polling places ran out of ballots. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has more.
Assembly Chair Debbie Osiander started off Tuesday's regular meeting by apologizing.
I deeply regret that polling places ran out of ballots during this municipal election. Every voter must be allowed to vote. No voter should be turned away. And for as long as I'm a member of this body, I will commit to making sure that a situation like this never happens again.
Assembly members L.V. Gray Jackson and Harriet Drummond proposed a resolution that would appoint a special counsel. Gray Jackson.
I really believe that this is the right thing to do. As I mentioned, these letters that we got from the ACLU are compelling. And Madam Chair, if I might, I would like Mr. Mittman from the ACLU to come to that podium so that the rest of the folks in this community can hear just how compelling their letters are.
Mittman briefed the assembly, but they voted the resolution down 7-4. Some said they may reconsider once they see reports by the municipal clerk and the election commission. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
The Go ship was not easy to sink. That was the experience for the crew of the Coast Guard cutter Anacapa. They had practiced with their deck gun, but never used it to actually scuttle a ship. The Petersburg-based cutter gained worldwide notoriety last week when she was ordered to sink the derelict Japanese fishing boat off the coast of southeast Alaska. Back in Petersburg, several of the Anacapa's crew gave a firsthand account to Matt Lichtenstein, who filed this report.
The Ryun Maru was about 160 miles off the coast when the Anacapa reached her. The cutter's crew spent the night making last-minute preparations and getting final approval to go ahead and start firing the next morning. That work included checking the derelict vessel for any radiation it may have picked up from the nuclear disasters in Japan. Executive Officer Jim Toomey says the cutter has an array of equipment for that.
Once we'd arrived on scene and began our study of the vessel, its seaworthiness, and any potential hazards that may on board, we actually used some of that radiation detection equipment, doing several passes anywhere from 30 yards to 300 yards off the vessel, and conducted basically a spectral analysis of any radioactive emissions from the vessel, and we didn't pick up any elevated levels.
Some initial reports put the vessel at around 160 feet long, but Toomey says they found it was closer in length to their 110-foot cutter. The Coast Guard didn't send any crew aboard the drifting boat, but another vessel did. Shortly before they began clearing the area for firing, a Canadian fishing boat arrived on scene to claim salvage rights. Anacapa Commanding Officer Ruben Boudreau says U.S. and Canadian Coast Guard officials had a conference call and subsequently agreed to let the would-be salvagers inspect the Japanese ship.
And they were actually able to put personnel on board as we were observing this and determined that it was truly a derelict, probably not seaworthy enough to tow back all the way to Canada, which was their plan. They reported that there were just the entire vessel was in shambles and could have sunk at any moment.
But even after being hit by the Japanese tsunami and drifting thousands of miles across the ocean, the unmanned fishing boat turned out to be tougher than she looked. Once the Canadian vessel cleared the scene, the Anacapa prepared to move forward with its task. Boudreau says they first put out repeated notices to vessels and aircraft, requiring them to stay at least 6 nautical miles away from their location. They commenced firing at about 1 in the afternoon that day. Having never done this sort of thing before, Boudreau says it was a huge learning experience.
Just trying to develop the best plan possible to sink the vessel, not knowing how long it would take or how many shots it would take below the waterline. She was a very seaworthy craft, obviously coming thousands of miles from west to east across the Pacific, and she didn't want to go down easy, that's for sure.
They started by firing 220 high-explosive rounds from their 25-millimeter deck gun. The cutter had to stay at least 300 yards away from the target vessel for those rounds to fully arm themselves and cause the most damage. At the same time, according to Boudreau, even the relatively calm seas caused enough movement to make it challenging for the Anacapa to hit the other boat below the waterline. After the high-explosive rounds didn't seem to do the trick, Boudreau says they eventually fired off another 220 rounds of regular non-explosive ammunition. According to Boudreau, that allowed them to get closer and make shots that were somewhat less destructive, but more accurate. Petty Officer Second Class Brandon Thomas fired 55 of those shots.
It's actually incredibly complicated because you got vessel with the water line that keeps changing because the swells keep moving it up and down, and our vessel's moving in relation to it. So the mount moves pretty freely, and you kind of try and track on there.
The Ryan Maru eventually sank at 6:15 p.m. Operations Petty Officer Rob Owens was on watch at the time.
It started sinking stern and starboard quarter, and then once that stern caught up to it all throughout, it just it almost kind of swung underneath the bow, and it was bow up, and then and just sank, you know, just stern first.
The decision to sink the boat had come from much higher up in the Coast Guard, which saw the unlit, unmanned vessel as a serious danger to navigation in busy shipping lanes. But the Anacapa crew saw that firsthand. Owens says when they arrived, there were at least three large tankers in the area, one of which couldn't see the derelict ship on its radar and radioed for its location. Owens and the other crew were confident there was minimal fuel on the vessel, which had been destined for scrap in Japan. The morning following the sinking, a Coast Guard aircraft on scene reported there was a little bit of debris and a light sheen that the agency said would dissipate quickly at sea. Anacapa Commander Boudreau says he's proud of his crew and he thinks their experience may help the Coast Guard deal with future situations like this.
There's going to be some great lessons learned as a result of this, especially moving forward and thinking that there may be some more vessels along the way that are going to be drifting in our direction. They're estimating a million or 2 million tons potentially of debris that is going to be following that same path and hitting Hawaii, British Columbia, and Alaska in the next year or two.
The Ryan Maru sank in 6,000 feet of water. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
There are still few details about a North Slope oil field accident that killed a Fairbanks man. Doyon Drilling worker David James, originally from Fort Yukon, died in the accident at an offshore drilling rig site on Monday. Roberta Quintavel, senior vice president and chief operating officer for parent company Doyon Limited, says she can't share any details of what happened, but adds the incident is being taken seriously.
We're very, very committed to safety, and we will ensure that there's a complete investigation, cooperation with all the appropriate authorities. Our condolences go to the family and friends and to, you know, the drilling community as a whole. Certainly the entire industry will be affected by this, and we'll continue to work with everyone.
The U.S. Occupational Safety and Health Administration is among the agencies investigating the offshore accident.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Grant Station, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com. And by Premera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, providing quality health plans to companies and individuals in Alaska for over 60 years. More at Premera.com. Premera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. We know the territory.
Alaskans are on their way to getting subsidized immunizations again. The Senate today passed a House bill reinstating the adult and children's immunization program, at least temporarily. The program was disassembled in 2009. Nome Democrat Donnie Olson said federal funding has dropped by 84% and all adult vaccinations have been stopped, as well as many vaccinations offered to children.
This program has held at bay a number of terrible diseases that are not just life-threatening, but they're also life-altering. And frequently these diseases cause death. I'm speaking namely of meningococcal meningitis, some of the rotaviruses, influenza, as well as pneumococcal.
The bill provides about $5 million annually for the program for the next 3 years and offers protection to uninsured and underinsured children. Olson says the program makes the basics available to everyone. The Senate did not change the bill from the version that passed the House, so it can now go before the governor for action. The State House today approved a bill creating a Kinnick Arm Crossing Fund that critics say could put the state on the hook for about $2.9 billion over the next 3 decades. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports.
It did not take the House much time to pass HB 158, the bill sponsored by Representative Mark Newman, a Wasilla Republican, passed the House 25-12. It has yet to pass the Senate. HB 158 sets up a financial mechanism which obligates the state to pay any Kinnickahm Bridge and Transportation Authority private partner for toll revenue shortfalls if current projections for bridge use and tolls do not materialize in the initial years after the bridge is completed. Mike Foster chairs Kubota's board.
The purpose of the reserve fund is to handle shortfalls and tolls in the initial years of the opening. We know in the initial years that toll revenue will be short of what we call our availability payment or our payment to our private partner.
Foster says the Kinnickahm Crossing Fund is one of the bill's three main provisions. It also increases the level of private activity bonds to be sold from $500 million to $600 million. Although neither the state nor Kubota would have fiscal responsibility for the bonds, HB 158 also eliminates any borough or municipal taxes on the Kinnickahm Bridge, which will be owned by the state. Bob French, speaking for Kinnick Bridge Facts, an Anchorage-based group opposed to Kubota, says HB 158's reserve fund only creates a loophole
to get around some of the prohibitions that Kubota has from obligating the state. It creates this reserve fund to pay availability payments to the public-private partner. It means that the state is guaranteeing those availability payments. And over the 35-year life of the project, that is a $2.98 billion liability that the state has.
French says availability payments only have two revenue streams, bridge tolls or state legislative appropriations.
Kubota will say that, you know, well, they're hoping to get, you know, $6 billion in tolls, so therefore there will be a net gain to the state. But if you look closely at the numbers that they're predicting, it's pretty obvious that there will be toll shortfalls, which means the state will be on the hook.
French says it is ironic that on Tuesday evening, the Anchorage Assembly passed a recommendation prohibiting any more local or state funds to be spent on Kubota. He says the House is bowing to pressure from Kubota, but Bill's sponsor, Representative Mark Newman, says opponents' numbers are skewed.
Actual projections show within 7 years it'll be revenue neutral, it'll be paying for itself, and bringing in a positive revenue to the state.
According to Kinnick Bridge Facts, $59.6 million has been spent on Kubota since 2003, money from federal earmarks that has been spent on rights of way and permits. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
The margins are slim and there are still votes to count, but it looks like Dillingham residents have approved Proposition 1 to annex the local Nooshiegak Commercial Fishing District into the city limits, and also approved the second proposition to impose a 2.5% raw fish tax. Both measures gained about 50 more votes in favor than those opposed. But as KDLG's Mike Mason reports, the final results won't be known till tomorrow.
The Dillingham City Clerk reports there are 115 absentee and question ballots that will be counted by the Dillingham Canvas Committee during their meeting Thursday afternoon at 5. Since there are so many absentee and question ballots, it's possible the vote totals for the two ballot questions could change substantially. Dillingham Mayor Alice Ruby is confident that the yes votes on the two ballot questions will stand up when all the votes are counted on Thursday.
The question still hasn't been answered, obviously. I'm really pleased with the voter turnout. It's obvious that we've got a large part of the community that's been engaged, and you know, that's a success regardless of the question that'd be on the ballot. But I'm optimistic. I mean, I think that the community it has spoken, but we'll wait until after Thursday for the final decision before we, you know, move to the next step.
Ruby notes the city council's already adopted some of the ordinances that would implement the annexation and the fish tax, contingent on the ballot questions passing when the vote totals are known on Thursday. She also stresses that many of the measures intended to provide some relief to the fish tax for area residents have also been adopted.
And the council did that so that, you know, the public could had time to see the commitment that was being made, the commitment for example, the reimbursements for the real property and the reimbursements for the low income and those things. most of those have been ongoing.
Thursday's special election prompted a large campaign in opposition to the annexation and fish tax. A segment of that opposition wanted the annexation turned down in an effort to make it easier to create a Western Bristol Bay borough. Ruby has long been a supporter of borough formation, and she pledged the city of Dillingham will continue to work in that direction.
Certainly, I've been an advocate of it, and the city is committed to it. The city has already established that borough fund and will contribute some of these proceeds into that fund.
Recently, a borough feasibility report was released by the Eacock Village Council that showed that a Western Bristol Bay borough could be financially feasible if a borough were to impose a 5% local fish tax in both the Nooshigak and Togiak commercial fishing districts. Robert Hyeno is the president of the Eacock Village Council. He was also among the most vocal opponents of the city's annexation effort, and he was the chairman of the anti-annexation group called Citizens for Sustainable Communities, opposing Dillingham's annexation and fish tax. That group ran what many area residents consider the largest campaign in Dillingham's history. Efforts to get a comment from Hyeno about Tuesday's unofficial election results have thus far been unsuccessful, but he spoke about the future during a campaign event Friday in Dillingham. He admitted that it will be challenging to actually get all of the stakeholders on board for a borough, and he claimed that if the annexation and fish tax actually passes, the area villages might not have much incentive to continue pursuing borough formation.
And then I guess if you ask me directly, I'd be very interested in pursuing this if Prop 1 and 2 went down. I don't think I'm going to put any time into it if it gets voted in, because I don't think the likelihood of it going anywhere is going to be very minimal.
If the results from Tuesday's special election in Dillingham stand up when the absentee and question ballots are counted, then the city of Dillingham would have jurisdiction over the Nooshigak Commercial Fishing District and the Wood River Special Harvest Area. Last year, there were nearly 5 million sockeye salmon caught by commercial fishermen in that fishing district. It's anticipated that a 2.5% local fish tax could bring in about $700,000 in additional revenue to the city. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, Rosemary Alexander in Juneau, Daisha Eaton and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Mike Mason in Dillingham. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
And by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
Home, it's where you lay your head, eat home-cooked meals, and gather with friends. Home is where you grew up and learned about life. Alaska is home, and when you choose to violate someone by committing sexual assault, you harm them, and you harm yourself, your friends, your family, your home, and Alaska. No one deserves to be sexually assaulted, so make the right choice. Real Alaskans choose respect. This message brought to you by the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.